First, let me thank Boris for inviting me here to share my work and learn. Most important, I think, learning something. When I see the work done with my student Zhou Shengqi, I should say replace with by, because as you know, the student did most of the work. Okay. I've been here for almost 2 days and learning a lot of physics and a lot of controversy. So today I'm not going to talk about physics, and I don't have much physics to report. I'm going to talk about the technique, okay? And I think it's important that we have some good technique to pin down some of the problems. If you want to get is this thing on? If you want to get a more fully picture, of course, the global measurements such as Nusselt number is very important. It gives you a handle on the overall dynamic state of the system. But the other more detailed things like boundary layer are also important. First of all, they can be used to test some of the specific assumptions and the predictions, such as the model reported by Datlov yesterday, and also in the model of Schriemann CGI. There are some specific requirements about the relative size of the viscous layer and the thermal boundary layer. And then next is how do you measure those boundary layer? Okay, there are actually no proven reliable techniques to measure viscous boundary layer in fluids such as mercury or helium, non-optical techniques. Okay, so we need to do that. I would like to emphasize at the outside that I'm not measuring velocity, but I'm determining viscous boundary layer thickness. So I'm going to I'm trying to convince you to by this technique, okay, so a lot of the people in the audience working with helium, mercury, and so forth would be able to use it. Okay, so more specifically, we know that one of the important questions is does this Krechner regime exist? James Glazier termed it as ultra hard. I think it's a very sexy term, sort of a soft, hard, ultra hard, so easy to remember. Okay, and of course, in this regime, the viscous boundary layer should be thinner than the thermal one, according to Schriemann CGI, and also in Krechner model, the viscous boundary layer is like disappearing or something. It's certainly thinner than the thermal boundary layer. And we know the helium and the mercury probably are the most hopeful candidates to search for this ultimate state, if it really exists. Okay. What we're going to do is to measure the cross-correlation of temperature fluctuations between two points space perpendicular to flow direction. Okay. And I'll report two results. And our technique is tested in water. Okay. So we already heard since yesterday the successful application of the cross-correlation spectroscopy, or when you place two probes along the flow direction, essentially what you do is you measure the delay time for some disturbance to pass the two probes successively. Okay, but near the conducting plates, the delay time and the velocity are not related in any simple way due to strong temperature fluctuations and the thermal gradient there. Okay. The technique I'm talking about here is based on the following observations, facts. First, it seems now well established that at least in aspect ratio one cell and most fluids, the large-scale circulation mean flow exists, and it is predominantly horizontal near the conducting plate. Okay. Yes. Yeah. Well, basically, this cross correlation technique that a lot of people using near the sidewall is to get the magnitude of the mean flow, and basically, it's you measure the time of a temperature fluctuation being advected passing through the tube. So it's sort of like a passive kind of thing. It's being passively advected, so you measure the time delay. But in the boundary layer there, you have strong temperature fluctuations. So if you get a fluctuation, you get another fluctuation. And how do you know this fluctuation is from the fluctuation that was in the other probe sometime later, or it's yeah. That's passive, right? Yeah. The mean, it's being carried by the mean flow. Yeah, sure. You have some coherent object there. Okay. So because you have this mean flow, strong mean flow there. If you imagine you have some temperature inhomogeneity or disturbance that was originated somewhere in the bottom, it will have much reduced probability to propagate straight upward due to the mean flow. Okay. So if I show you a cartoon, it will become clear. And this is a blow-up picture of the mean velocity profile near the boundary layer. So this is the thickness of the boundary layer. The thing here is that inside the boundary layer, you have a strong shear and a very large velocity gradient as compared to outside. Okay, outside it decays as Punger showed this morning, but much slower. Okay, so if you have two probes, actually the most ideal situation is the separation of the probe is larger than the viscous boundary layer, and that's the condition of our measurement. But this cartoon is not drawn very properly. So what happens is if you start this low probe at the bottom, okay, this top probe outside the boundary layer, and as you move up, the velocity difference at the two locations of the two probe will decrease as you move up. Because here, before it was at the largest velocity, and this at the bottom, zero velocity. Okay, so the velocity difference at the locations of the two probe will decrease as you move up. And therefore, the spatial correlation will increase. On average, it's laminar. It's the you have a mean shear.
The fluctuations correlate as well.
Correct. But if, as I show, that you are doing statistics, okay. So the ones that are not being destroyed will be picked up. Okay. So. Experimentally, what we do is we measure the cross-correlation function of two temperature signals from two probes that are spaced by perpendicular to the mean flow. And what we do is actually we only get the amplitude of the correlation function or its maximum value. Okay, we don't worry about the functional form. So I'll now talk about this. It's a cylindrical water cell, 20 centimeter by 20 centimeter, same as the one Punger talked about this morning. We have two semester probes here. Okay, they are 300 micron in size. Okay. And I just, this is a needle of half millimeter. That's a stainless steel tube of about one millimeter diameter. Okay. So you move this two together. Actually, I just realized this morning I can reduce the disturbance at the boundary layer by sort of doing this kind of construction. Okay, so this is the, you know, this is the boundary layer. Instead of like this, it, and this is, of course, at the same vertical. Anyway, that's just a comment I realized. Of course, like this, you'll see there's more perturbation to see. So what you do is your semester is one arm of a AC bridge, and then it's modulated by some sinusoidal signal. We use locking to demodulate the signal and send it to signal analyzer. For two probe, we have we duplicate this circuit here, and this one we have four channels, so we actually can do four simultaneous temperature measurement. And what we do is we take the time series for 2 hours. Now, the voltage, of course, we convert it into resistance and into temperature using calibration. Okay, it's a specific calculation. So here are the time series, a segment of the time series. It's about 2 minutes. And the total time series is 2 hours, which corresponding to roughly 120 added 10 over time, okay, in the system. And the here is the distance of the lower probe from the bottom plate, okay. And you can see as you increase the correlation improves, okay. And it's more obvious as you move up. Okay, to outside the boundary layers, you can see. And that's for a probe separation of 2 millimeter, and same thing for large separation. Of course, it's just the overall correlation is reduced, but this is near the boundary layer. If you go to the outside, you can see the overall correlation is increasing. So let me show you a correlation function. This is just computed from the two time series. Okay. Let me remind you that's a correlation function, and we can say that of course it's a symmetric because we computed right using the tau zero, positive negative. And it decays to zero, so we get a non-amplitude. Okay. I'll talk about this peak position of this correlation function later. Okay. So you notice that the amplitude here is about 0.5 when z is 1.2 millimeter. Okay. And as you go up, the amplitude increases. Okay, so we can do this for a series of heights. We get a profile. Okay, and it looks like this. Okay, it's linear near the bottom plate. That means your degree of correlation increases linearly because this velocity gradient is constant. You have linear velocity distribution. I think that's basically is that. And it turns around here. That's an indication that the second probe has emerged from the boundary layer, the deep velocity gradient region. Okay. Then we make this sort of a drawing, extrapolation. This is just an operational definition of the boundary layer. Essentially, it allows you to do it in a consistent and uniform way. Okay. So if we do it here, we get a length we call delta r, and we have, of course, direct boundary layer thickness measurement for water using a laser scattering technique, and here is the direct velocity measurement result. Okay. Then we can do this for different Rayleigh number, and here are the comparison. Okay. Delta R is the so that delta is now from my slides. That delta R is the length that we obtain from the correlation of the temperature probe. Delta V is the velocity result that we published in 1996. And we put thermal boundary layer here just for comparison, because later on we'll use it for mixing zone. Okay. So you can see that in this technique, basically we take advantage of the mean flow. As long as you have horizontal mean flow, essentially we do not assume you have, you know, that some specific properties being placed or requirement placed on this, on the plumes. Okay. Okay. So next, I'll turn into the this peak position of the correlation function. If you noticed, that this correlation function, this peak position, of course, gives you the most probable delay time of signal, and you notice it's negative. Now, negative here means what? This T1 is the lower probe, T2 is upper probe. So tau 0 negative means most of the time your temperature disturbance reaches the upper probe first before it reaches the bottom probe. Okay. So what does that mean? Yeah, the copper. Did you say it's copper
circuit? The power surface.
Yeah, yeah.
Now you're showing the
lower surface.
So why is the direction different?
Well, I'm going to talk about it now. Now, here is some cartoon that I draw. Now, you, this is the thermal boundary layer. That's our two probe there. Because of this horizontal shear of horizontal velocity, your thermal objects such as plumes are being sheared or tilted with an angle. Okay, and this picture actually I copied from the celebrated GFM paper by Castano in 1989. And if you are not convinced, let me show you something else. This is a copy from the book by Kalanov called From Chaos to Orders or something. It's a collection of his paper. And here's a cartoon which shows the plumes are being sheared, tilted. So that means if you have a upper probe here, lower probe there, of course it will reach the upper probe first. And that explains why your tau zero is negative. And as you move up, your tau zero will decrease or will decrease in magnitude or increase in absolute. And we'll, let me show you the profile of this tau zero. This, yes, tau zero, this peak position. Okay. And you can see that start from negative approach to zero, then I don't actually quite understand why I have something like this, right? But it's comparing to this, it's much less. So basically, it shows there is depending on your definition, if you use absolute value, there is a minimum tau zero, which means at that position, there is not much delay. The in the mixing zone model, there's an argument in the 1989 GFM paper at the upper end of the so-called mixing zone. What happens is your thermal plumes are being merged into the mean flow, so they are being carried. So there, the velocity are uniform. You don't have this gradient. Okay. Just a second. Let me. I have two more slides. I'll finish. Then we can discuss. Give you questions. Okay. So actually, this mixing zone, since it's been proposed in the model by Castan et al. In the celebrated paper, has been observed by flow visualization. Basically, after this paper, Lipschitz group did visualization study in water, and they found that actually outside the boundary layer there is a region of strong mixing and the plumes sharing, sort of thing that the Punger talked about. But they also had some specific predictions about the width of the mix zone, which I believe has not been determined before, until this morning when Punger reported his result. Okay, I didn't know this. And later on, Prakasha and all this paper, Emily and Peter Constantin are all authors, then Kalanov of Lipschitz and so forth. They fixed this prefactor. Okay, so this is something you cannot fit or adjust. It's exact, sort of, in the sense that. So let's compare this. With our delta D. Of course, our delta D is measured from the bottom. So if you use the mixing zone picture, you have to subtract out the thermal boundary layer. Right? The mixing zone is this. You have to subtract the thermal boundary layer. That's the width thickness. Anyway, that's much small. The thermal boundary layer is here. The subtraction doesn't really make much difference. So the dashed line is the prediction by Prakasha et al. Okay, just that formula. I just plug in 20 centimeter, that's the height of my cell, into here, and plot it. And this tau zero are just the minimum for that, this dm just determined from that peak position of that delay. Basically, that's minimum delay means these plumes are being carried horizontally, not tilted.
So the negative time delay that you observe, that means you have a plume that's coming across like this, mm-hmm. and the hot temperature gets to the upper plume first?
Yeah, near the...
Near the boundary.
Yeah, as you go up, this delay...
It becomes less and less.
It's
always negative, that's bad.
Yeah. Well, it's actually it depends on the probe separation for this. When our probe separation is large enough, we did get the, you know, as you go out into this region, of course the vertical component will gradually take over. You should have a vertical velocity, then this plume will be passing the low one first, then yeah. So but for small probe separation, you don't reach that. Actually, we have one that goes into the positive. And actually, we don't quite. This is 3 some millimeter. So the 3.5 millimeter. A few millimeters. The thickness, yeah, the thickness of the boundary layer actually is compatible. The best situation is that the probe separation is a little bit larger than the thickness. So in this sense, it's good that even if in the gas and the mercury case where your boundary is very thin, you don't have to stick 2 probes into your boundary layer. It's only 1 probe inside. That's what you do in thermal temperature profile measurement. And the other just outside. And this L, you can see, is irrelevant as long as it's not too large or too small. because we are not making any time measurements of velocity. Of course, in this, you don't get any velocity. We're just using the fact you have this horizontal shear and you have this turning. Yes. Yes. In Mercury. Yeah. But this technique, I think it's simple enough. You can do it. There may not be a, you can check whether this really is for different system. Okay, this may be unlucky or coincidence. Of course, there's some, there's no fitting here. I'm just plot them together. And of course, this method is, I would say it's sort of not really quantitative, right? You're just using some properties, some turning points. So I wouldn't say it's extremely quantitative, but on the other hand, as I said, the especially for the viscous boundary layer determination, essentially we just take advantage of this large scale circulation. Okay, no any other assumptions. So if you forgive the intrusiveness of the two probes, it should be tested. And also I would like to, because there's some debate this morning about the power spectral method, right? I'm not suggesting that it is wrong or at least our technique can provide a cross-check because there are results obtained in gas and mercury using this power spectral method, and I think our method provides an alternative.
Yeah.
Yeah, we did. If I have time, I'll have a. If I have time, do I have time? So that's the summary of the formal talk, and it will be unfair now to mention the power spectral method. And so I think a lot of people know this method, so I don't have to. Essentially, that power spectrum, there is a cutoff which corresponding to a time scale, right? A minimum time, and that's the time that is being argued by Monti et al. It's the time that your plumes are being advected passing through your probe. Okay, at the speed of the mean flow. Okay. And then put the velocity profile and this power spectrum profile together, cutoff frequency. But this was done at a single Rayleigh number. I think that's always the debate, and also just for water. Okay, not for other. And here's the results, okay. So we also did, and the reason that this is nice, we did 6-hour power spectrum time series, so you get a nice clean cutoff. But then we can also do the sort of thing, and we found indeed there is a maximum as seen by Belmonte et al. And actually, there are some uncertainty. Okay. So first of all, immediately, this has somewhat larger uncertainty than the delta R I just talked about, which is you can systematically define. Okay. But anyway, here's the result. Indeed, it tracks. Okay. I use the word that it tracks the viscous boundary layer. So this is our 1996 light scattering results, and this is the from the power spectral method. Okay. Now, does it mean it it works, the power spectral method? Well, this is the argument that I said provided by Belmonte et al. Essentially, they said you have a thermal boundary layer, a plume, which is typically the width, the size of the plume is the width of a thermal boundary layer. It's been affected by the large flow, and the large-scale flow is really to the 1/2, and the thermal boundary layer goes as -2/7, so that the magnitude of this cutoff frequency maximum should have this one. And indeed, they found a nice power law here. So that let's see if we can get for our water, since in our water, U also goes as 1/2, and the thermal boundary layer also goes as -2/7, if you believe there is a power law, okay? And so that's this same plot, okay, non-dimensionalized frequency, and it's curved, okay? It's not a power law. Of course, this doesn't mean the power spectrum method is wrong. It just means that the argument that this cutoff is originally from a plume of the size of a thermal boundary layer may not be working for water. So I would say that it means my test is inconclusive. It attracts water well, okay? But the argument or the justification does not apply to water, which means you cannot safely extrapolate this method to other Prandtl number systems. So that's the if I dare to make some comparison or speculation, there's another point which depends on whether you accept this method. So this is the result obtained by Belmonte et al. Using this power spectrum method in gas, and they obtained this result. Okay. And this is the light scattering result we obtained in 1996. Okay. And our results is checked over 3 decades of really number. Now, in this PRL paper, it's only 2 decades, and later on we use different aspect ratio. So we expanded the range and still get this. So what does this imply? Now, the mean flow velocity goes as Rayleigh number to the 1/2 in both water and the SF6 gas. Okay, and of course, with the boundary layer and the velocity, you define a shear. And from those two results, you get two different shear. Okay. Then it means that you have the same thermal boundary layer, but they are controlled by different shear. And we know, according to the argument of Schumann CGI, the thermal boundary layer is modified or controlled by the shear. So that means the shear seems to be irrelevant here. For of course, this result, because it's for two different Prandtl number. Okay, so that. They are not the same. It's not no surprise, but then you can speculate. I wouldn't show it here.
Okay. Thank you a lot. Thank you. More questions? I have a question about whether you tried your method with time correlation of the temperature series on the sidewalls. So the sidewalls, you should see the plume passing through the two probes at the same time. Did you see this?
No, not yet. I think maybe James can comment. The two probe near the sidewall has been used right before, which is along the flow direction. So you measure the. Well, no, it's exact. It has to be appropriate range.
Right.
It cannot be too small.
What would too large be as the ratio, right?
Well, actually, we have it as large as 7 millimeter, and we can still get some. Yeah. Actually, if it's smaller than the boundary layer, it still works. It's just the profile is more complicated. Okay, I can show you if I have time. So that to make things simple, the separation is larger than boundary layer is okay.
In our experiment, we've got this vertically spaced probe.
Yes.
Boundary layer, but we never did the cross for a layer.
Yes. Maybe more, you should try.
More questions, bro?
Your argument about shear being irrelevant.
Yeah, that's, I said, it's all speculation there, unless the power spectrum method is right. Unless you, you know, you, so that my argument may not, so that's, if the two, you accept the two result, then you obtain this. So that's what I, so that if you, that sort of put back a doubt on the method, if you think that should the shear there should modify the thermal boundary layer, because it And remember, I did not say it's wrong.
No,
what I'm saying is my test is inconclusive.
Right. I'm not going to say it's wrong.
Yeah. But I think now you can compare the two techniques.
This is work that me and Axel Brandenburg worked on a few years ago. And there's one point missing on the plot here, and one point that doesn't fit. So we went and redid some calculations and we've never gotten back to finishing it. But what we did is we did some very complicated analysis on wave number spectra at different heights, because at that point I did not have frequency data to do anything with. But an effective way to consider the wave number cutoff in the horizontal in an aspect ratio one cell of gas, Prandtl number 0.7, with a very strong recirculation pattern, and then one of my very broad calculations that does not have any sort of pattern, is that if you take the horizontal dissipation of the scalar variance and divide it by the scalar variance, that's an effective measure of what the frequency cutoff at any given height is. So what you see here in this lower figure is that dashed line is the aspect ratio of six calculations, so there's a very strong peak right near the boundary. But the aspect ratio one calculation is basically constant across the center. And as a result, then what you do is if you take that wave number cutoff, you multiply it by the mean velocity at that height. So that's the other point here, is that you have velocity fluctuation represent aspect ratio of 1 and aspect ratio of 6. And there's a real major difference in the form of the mean velocity profile in that this has a peak and then decreases fairly sharply to a smaller value in the center. This has this peak near the boundary, but it does not decrease anywhere near rapidly. So we have two significant differences in velocity profiles and wave number cutoff profiles for the two different situations. And what you do to get a frequency is you multiply this by that, essentially. And when I do that for aspect ratio 6, and I compare that prediction, which is solid line is the frequency and K is the wave number cutoff, and I compare that with the physician's aspect ratio 6 here and here, I get a really nice correlation where that prediction for the large aspect ratio of the boundary layer thickness does work.
But when you do it because of this very different profile here for the aspect ratio 1, and then you calculate the cutoff as a function of Rayleigh number, what you get is this solid line here, which is decreasing slowly and agrees exactly with the measured value for the frequency cutoff determination of a boundary layer over that range of Rayleigh numbers for the experiment of Del Monte filter and Leibscher variable. And then at just beyond the highest Rayleigh number that I can do, which for this is 10 to the 8, they have a sharp drop. And the reason we didn't publish that is actually our 10 to the 8 is the star up here, which is an outlier. And we felt that was mainly due to the fact it turned out I hadn't run a high enough resolution for that case. So that's a real light scale. For most situations, it seems in water, in a wide aspect ratio, gas, maybe for mercury, and we can talk about looking for things in your data that might make sense. It looks like it's a reasonable measure, but if you have any sort of scale of dissipation profile that looks like that across the center, it probably is not a valid method to use. And so their prediction of that very sharp cutoff and a crossover, which you just showed, probably isn't meaningful. A little thing on that.
More comments? Well, I think we should move to the next speaker, which is Gertrude.